Welcome to Season 3 of Beyond the Wall, a Game of Thrones LCG podcast brought to you by Istral and Darknotch. We'd like to thank FFG and CardGameDB for their continued support, and the fantastic AGOT community as a whole for being the sole reason we do this cast. Thank you for letting us take you once again beyond the wall.
Welcome to another episode of Beyond the Wall. Today we're going to have a quick intro, then we're going to be joined by JC Wama to discuss some hidden gems of the current meta, and then we'll have some closing comments.
Episode 23, John. This is, 23 is probably a good number, but this two-week thing is still confusing me because I realized that I hadn't yet got a chance to talk about the annals that I launched over a week ago, which normally would have made last episode. So very confusing.
I'm not going to make any comment on why you're confused by a very simplistic idea.
Well, that's very kind of you, John.
Yep.
You're a gentleman.
Yeah,
you're pure
gentleman. Kindness, yeah.
But for those of you who don't know, the Annals have been updated, relaunched. It's a new URL as well. It's Annals Castle Black. Remember, two N's. You don't want to know what you get if you only type one N.
I kind of do now. Let me go. Oh, my God. Okay, don't.
And yeah, it really, with the help of Jason Wentworth, who does the setup analyzer, and Michael Henry Landeseck, who did graphic design for a whole bunch of projects like AMC and the Draft Masters, this version of the Annals is basically what I envisioned like 3 years ago when I started it. This is what I wanted it to be, and now I can work on making it more than that, and it's really exciting. Within the next 2 or 3 days of this airing, we should have integration with the Jousting Pavilion, so you can just import a tournament directly and don't have to manually type it, which I think will be huge. Not that I'm not already typing in all those tournaments manually, but I'd love to save, 4 hours a week or whatever it is. So I'm really excited about the Annals, and I think that shows up in our next segment because I keep mentioning it.
Yeah, we talked about it a little bit. It looks really sweet. The graphics are great. I think you guys did a great job.
So news of the week, the biggest one, which is now also over a week old, is that there's some delays in shipping. That Fantasy Flight is almost certainly affected by a company called Hanjin going into receivership, and they're responsible for about 8% of Pacific shipping.
Yeah, this is pretty big because what I think it means is that we probably won't have Valor Morghulis for Worlds, and it means that the Worlds meta will be more similar to the meta of today, which is actually a pretty good meta.
It is a pretty good meta. I think it is a shame to have this delay, just because, the landing box was so exciting. We've seen so much of it, and Valor was sort of anticipated as well and should be very exciting. But I think this shipping problem is really unfortunate in general. I mean, people have been talking about how a lot of companies are affected. Some have their stuff on those boats and just don't know if they'll get access to it because the company's going into receivership and a bunch of its ships haven't docked for fear of being seized. And a bunch of dock workers won't unload things for fear of
not getting paid.
Yep. So not only is that 8% of Pacific shipping gone, and so the other companies are going to start charging more as well. I think the forecast is that it's going to be a very expensive Christmas this year.
That's what I hear.
But yeah, no Valor for Worlds seems very, very likely. We do have a release date for Chapter Pack 3. That's October 6th, for those of you who still haven't heard. Which, unless they really compress the gap in between CP4 and CP3, means it won't be in time for the 11 days before Worlds.
And I can't see them doing that, to be honest.
Well, I'm actually surprised by the fact that it's delaying the chapter packs, because we really haven't seen delays in chapter packs in North America. Once the first one of a cycle comes out, the rest have been fairly regular. And so the theory was always that they were printed together, that they were shipped together, and that they were sitting in FFG's warehouses distributed 1 month.
It doesn't sound like that. Maybe with Asmodean, they may have changed things up.
It's possible, yeah, with the increased volume, that they could justify printing just one chapter pack.
Yeah, because they'd be shipping more than just the single chapter pack, right? They'd be shipping all their other products.
Yeah, and the other thing that it might be is that they're looking ahead and they don't want too big of a gap between the second cycle and the third cycle. And they know that this is going to cause problems for shipping down the road. So they're going to, give us every 6 weeks instead of every month to buy a little bit of a buffer for the next cycle.
which makes strategic sense, right? Because when you have, 4 months with no chapter packs, it's a much bigger impact than having a
A couple of
couple.
2 weeks extra, yeah.
Yeah, for sure. FFG, what you could do, and this is, I think would be a great idea, just make Valor, okay for Worlds, announce it right now, give an alternate out art Valor to everyone that shows up, and there you go, meta shifted.
Yeah, but as you stated earlier, I mean, I'm not necessarily opposed to that idea. I think they could communicate it, and if they were supplying it as an alt art already, or if their turnaround on their printing facilities is fast enough, that could be a pretty cool thing to do, although it would feel a little forced. But the question is it really necessary? As we talk about later in this segment, and as the results of the last 2 weeks, which we didn't know when we recorded this segment, so we're now going to sound a little
Recapitulative.
instead of like innovative.
Predicting the
But
future.
yeah, the tournaments from the last 2 weeks have been hugely varied and have been extremely exciting betas, with new decks sort of latching on and catching on, and then being seen in subsequent tournaments doing very, very well. From the weekend where we had Polish Nationals, the Battle of Summerhall, and Italian Nationals, we had decks come out of there. Oh, and Dutch Nationals as well. We had the Night's Watch Wolf was posted the next day by Bambi. He was second in Dutch Nationals and lost to Atard KOS. And
We
that
saw
deck
it
has seen a
appear.
ton of play this week at Nordic Championships, included by, well, I don't know if it was exactly the same deck, but Jakob and Andreas were both playing a Night's Watch Wolf that made it to the finals of Nordic Championships, which was won by
Very
Vera.
similar cards, yeah.
And in fact, the variety of decks winning has been really neat. Battle of Summerhall was a smaller tournament, but it was Greyjoy Fealty won against Tyrell. Polish Nationals was Night's Watch Kraken against Barra Fealty. Italian Nationals was Targ Fealty against Lani Fealty. We haven't seen a lot of Lani Fealty. Czech Nationals was Barra Summer versus Alani Lord of the Crossing. Nordic Championship was Barra Fealty winning against Night's Watch Wolf. And Spanish Nationals was a Night's Watch Kings of Winter beating a Tyrell Lion in a field of 68. Tyrell at the top of a field of 68 in the final.
Fluke. That one was a fluke,
You think it's
Alex.
a
Just
fluke?
accept it. Yeah. Tyrell's not good still. Sorry.
I think you may be right, but we haven't seen this Tyrell Lion list. I'd like to see it and see, yes, it's possible to get there at random or with really good pilot skill with a deck like that or really good matchups, and this could be a fluke, but I'm hesitant to dismiss it as such.
All right. On the air officially, I'm dismissing it as a fluke.
All right. Well, hopefully that list gets posted in the next few days. But I
Yeah,
think,
I mean, I hope I'm proven wrong, but
I mean, I'm inclined to agree with you in that I don't see anything very recent that could push that deck that much. I mean, the new Knights of Summer are excellent cards, but they don't just drive me towards Tyrell as a main faction. I think it'll be the Lani box that might do that.
yeah, Lenny Box and a couple more chapter packs. I think Tyrell gets a lot better, but right now, I'm sorry, I don't feel that they have a tier one build.
So the only other news I want to talk about is your mentorship program. What's going on there, eh?
So we had a ton of applicants, and I ended up deciding to pick two instead of one because there's just so many people. So our first meetup is going to be the Monday that this episode airs. The three of us are going to start that up, and you're going to hear about it in the next episode.
So what sort of segment can listeners expect in the
Well, you're
next episode, both the like training session or the briefing, and then the like follow up the next week, or how does that work?
Yeah, so they're going to hear a little bit about the two people that were selected, which was completely at random, what their objectives are, what they're trying to achieve with the program, and you're going to hear about the homework I assigned to them and what they learned from that homework. So really, I'm going to be trying to drive them to express what they're gaining from the program. So they might be telling you it's crap, but hopefully they'll be telling you that they learned something.
All right. Well, that sounds like something to look forward to. That's about it for the intro. I don't have any other news.
Well, you covered it all. You named every tournament in order and all the tops. It's like you've been keying them into the annals or something.
Yeah. And the spreadsheet that we fought about last week
Didn't look at that.
that you're not currently, looking at. I can
Yeah.
see that.
Sorry, Alex. Right, folks, we're joined by a very special guest today. He is what many people think as an innovative builder. He hails from Great Britain, and you may know him as JC Wama. Hello, Mr. Wama.
Hello, Mr. Nodge.
He's Mr. Nodge? He's never been Mr. Nodge before.
I'm Mr. Nodge today, Alex. I hope you're having a fantastic day, because we're here to talk about a topic I think that is really near to your heart, and that is innovative deck building and kind of pushing the envelope to try new things in tournaments. You're known recently for your Tyrell build with a banner to Martell that was pretty different, and we're hoping today you're going to help us build some new and interesting things.
I'll try my best. Although it's worth pointing out, credit where credit's due, that was Drakey's build that I just kind of popularized.
Just an interesting point, because the Annals just relaunched and people can look at this now. Do you want to guess what the two Tyrell decks with a positive qualification ratio are, James?
Banner Sun.
Yeah.
I don't know. Because I think the next best after Banner Sun would be Crossing, but I assume enough people have played that and not made the cut that it's... ratio would still be poor.
Its ratio is actually better than Sun at the moment, but they're the only two positives, you're right.
Okay.
Over the last 3 months, I guess I should have specified. So congratulations, you are most of the data points that are putting Tyrell's QR at not negative 1.5.
No one else plays them.
There was a point in the Annals where there were, I think it was four instances of Tyrell having made the cut at premier events in Europe and North America, and I was three of them.
I do remember
I both lamented and enjoyed in equal measure.
I don't think FFG ever intended for House Loyalty to be this exclusive. Like, Tyrell has become...
Yeah, he claimed it first. No one else can be loyal to Tyrell. So, John, I assume the reason for doing this is because you think Canadians are terrible and they all played Lanny Dragon?
No, I think Canadians are awesome, and I'm sure they took the deck that they thought was the best. After all, Canadians did create the Lanny Dragon build. We were the first ones to play it in a big tournament and then post it. So, you know, I have to take credit for that.
Take credit. Oh, humble John.
I mean, for Canada in general, like all of it, taking the full credit. I'm sure other people were thinking of the build and playing it. We were just lucky enough to play it first. Go Canada. Yay. So maybe they were just loyalists. Maybe they were just loyals to that, you know, that Canadian soup. But yeah, I think people everywhere, especially in North America, are playing decks that they've seen win other major events that have been on the net, and they're not really exploring enough, because I feel that right now in 2.0, there is so much potential for so many decks that we're just not seeing people play. So I'm hoping that between the four of us, we're actually going to talk about, you know, some of the upcoming cards that are going to really inspire deck building, because let's be honest, almost all that landing box has been spoiled. When I go on Thrones DB, I can see almost all of it. And there's so much potential there. Don't you guys agree?
Absolutely. I mean, there's new agendas coming out, so.
Yeah, I think it's mostly been from this second chapter back that's given us two new agendas, that's given us plots that have changed the plot game, that made Pantoshi worse, that's given us a driving force for Night's Watch, that's opened up the meta, and for some reason, some people haven't taken advantage of that yet. And there's a delay before we've seen it diversify in North America, while we've seen it diversify almost instantly in Europe.
I don't think that's fair to say, though. Does it need to diversify? I think Lanny Dragon is good, even with the new cards and the new meta. I think it's made better by a lot of the new plot options it has. It almost sounds like you're saying that Europe took the new cards and then made their pool better. But I don't think that's fair to say. I still think Lanny Dragon is quite good.
No, they just made it different. I think what Alex is trying to say is that they've taken this new chapter pack, embraced it more quickly, and so there's a more varied deck lists that are showing up at these tournaments instead of, you know, the tried and true, which is still a top contender, but it's the tried and true one. Sometimes, you know, you want a little spice in your life.
Not for nationals. That's like going to Worlds with a fun deck. I think you want to take the deck that you want to win with, which was my reason for taking Lannister Dragon. It had nothing to do with comfort. I'd barely played the deck before, but it was a really easy deck to play, and I thought it would win. Not to sound defensive. If I sound a little bit strange, it's because I have a fever right now, and I just got scratched up by my cat. You're going to hear him meowing in the background the whole time, because he's not allowed in my room right now. He's in timeout.
I guess maybe, James, if you want to give a quick thought on whether One Meta has embraced things faster or why that might be, because I want to then tear into Sean a little bit more about Mighty Dragon and why I think it could disappear.
I do have a hypothesis about it, and it's entirely unfounded. So, rampant speculation ahoy. But I think partly it's to do with the shadow currently being cast over the game by Valar Morghulis. And I think in Europe, the sort of the big tournaments are quite regularly spaced out, you know, like after, you know, Fleabottom, like there was Fleabottom Fracas like a week after Gen Con, and then a couple of weeks after the Fracas, there was Warburg Morgulis, and then, you know, there's been the Dutch Nationals this last weekend, and so on and so on. And so there's a constant need to evolve. Whereas in America, obviously with Canada, there was the Canadian Nationals recently, but broadly speaking, in America, you've got Gen Con and then like a 2 or 3 month gap with sort of, you know, fan made tournaments, maybe, but nothing too prestigious and important as a general rule. And then Worlds. And while there have been chapter pack delays, I think people were broadly expecting Valor to be out for Worlds, and they're sort of setting Worlds as their next thing they need to build a deck for, and are seeing very little point in spending too much time trying to solve the meta in between sort of packs 2 and 4, whereas that's not the issue in Europe.
You know, I hate it when we have guests that are so much righter than I could have been.
Damn, that was insightful. Yeah, I think that's true. Let's cut that part out, Sean. And okay, I think it's because
I feel like, I don't know, maybe I'm yelling at the wind here because it seems like 3 against 1, but I still think the Lannister Dragon is amazing in the current meta.
Oh, absolutely. I think it's one of the best decks in the meta. And I think at the very least for this pack and for next pack, and maybe even once Valor is out, it will still be one of the absolute best decks. Although I think possibly Lanny Kraken will overtake it for sort of the general good stuff aggro deck at that point. But
plus the Iron Mines and keeping sustain. Yeah. I think the reason why the Lannister Dragon is still alive in the meta is that our plot options expanded despite having the new choke come out. By running 2 summer and 2 winter, I was effectively able to nullify any early game choke that might happen, right? Where I would just play a summer plot with high gold, and if they were to try and hit me with Meager or White Tree, the effects of Tywin plus the summer trait kept me in the game and able to build a board. So, I don't know.
My argument right now with the Lanny Dragon is I think the latest pack hurt it, and I think it's for a couple of reasons. One is it makes things like Pentoshi, which can be used to drop, say, 2 big impact characters, and really that Lanny Dragon has a whole bunch of high-impact characters, very, very good ones, and you really can't play as much Pentoshi anymore because of the Summer Harvest and things like that. And secondly, because cards like Milk of the Poppy are excellent at countering really big, expensive characters.
Craven.
And Craven is exactly that. I think that Craven is a huge, disproportionately better against the stronger, more invested you are in your character. And so Craven becomes better against Lanny Dragon. Milk of the Poppy has always been good against Lanny Dragon. It doesn't have that much attachment clearing built into the deck, and so you're getting disproportionate effectiveness. I think that almost any Watch banner running 3 Milks and 3 Cravens is going to have a plus matchup against Lannister.
I don't know if I agree with that as much as, like, I think if you'd made that argument to me a couple of weeks ago, I would have been on board. But I've been thinking about it, and I think Lanny Dragon is actually one of the few decks that can put out enough big characters that Craven is an annoyance rather than a game ender. Whereas, for example, in Targaryen, if you were able to get Craven on Daenerys and you're able to get Craven on Drogo, you've basically sort of shut the deck down. In Greyjoy, if you get it on Balon and Euron, and so on. And in all these other factions, there's sort of like there's 1 or 2 big characters. Whereas in Lanny Dragon, it's Tywin, it's Tyrion, it's Jaime, it's Gregor, it's Miri. So I'm not sure if there are enough Cravens to be able to deal with them all.
Well, I didn't want to jump into this right away, but I will, because one of my favorite decks right now is a Targaryen Night's Watch running 3 Melk and 3 Craven. And I have to agree with you, James, that, you know, Lanny has all these great big characters, but they only ever get 1 or 2 of them out at the same time in early game. And if you can slow that huge push they have, they're actually not that great at late game because their draw in general is pretty poor in the Lanny Dragon. So if you can get some pressure going and start removing their characters, maybe with some Dracarys, then they have really a hard time to keep up with that type of pressure if they can't retaliate in the same way. And Craven removes that retaliation. No Mountain, no Tywin. It's so good.
But, I mean, the meta is heavily attachments. So every good Lanny Dragon's running 3 Rattleshirts and Confiscation. So getting rid of one of your, you know, 6 attachments that you might drop is not that hard.
I think that that's actually the case I would make against what JC was saying. Because actually, yeah, you're right. Targ definitely has Khal Drogo, definitely has Daenerys. And those are Craven, you're suffering. But it also has regularly 3 copies of Viserys. And it also has Waking the Dragon, which can both bounce Viserys or bounce Drogo or bounce Dany to clear the attachments. And so I've actually found attachment control to be a more important factor in making your big characters more impactful. And I think that it Rattleshirts is useful and is appearing in almost all of my decks. But when I have to protect these big characters like that, you need alternate sources as well. And I think that's where the Loyal Targ stuff actually works out better rather than the Lannister, which Lannister itself brings nothing to the table to clear the attachments.
That's fair. I mean, I'm probably biased from the game that I went to last weekend where my Daenerys was Cravened. I played Viserys. My Viserys was milked. I killed my Viserys, used Close Call to put him in my discard pile, played another copy of Viserys, and that Viserys was also milked.
You should have just Wakened the Dragon Dany and played her again.
Yeah, that was not in my deck, and will be in the next version of that deck.
It should, because the triggers you can get out of Viserys with it are fantastic.
Yeah.
Right now in this meta. All right, so John, you're gonna tell us a little bit more about a Targ Night's Watch that you think is competitive.
Yeah, I think there's not that much Night's Watch showing up at the top of tournaments, but I really do feel that there's a Targ Night's Watch build that can be competitive. And I think that's basically based on the fact that one of Targ's biggest issues so far to date is this big character meta. They're able to deal with, the 4 to 5 strength characters pretty easily. But once, a couple of these huge bombs hit the table, they kind of struggle. And if they don't see an early melk to basically neutralize that character, they can't do much. But now with Kraven in the game, they can do so much more. An early Kraven or an early melk shuts down that big character. They burn out the small ones, and then very quickly those bigger characters fall to their pressure. And I think that Targ's in a great place because it really has, in this last pack, not only gained the ability to banner with Night's Watch for Kraven, but it's gotten a lot more draw. We had Funeral Pyre before, but now we have that little weenie that gains insight when she attacks with a lord or lady. And that makes all the difference in the world. It really allows Targ to focus on draw. And people, I think, are also underestimating the bigger king. And I'm hoping... All right, well, I know that James was running the Bigger King in his build. He had to be. Yes. Because it's just such an amazing card for economy that it changes the way people can play Targ, because you can actually put things like Counting Coppers in your deck and still have 4 or 5 gold to spend on impactful characters. And these are the main reasons that I think Targ's Night's Watch is rising, but I don't see anyone playing it. And maybe that's just because I haven't played it, tested enough with it, and there's all these flaws. But from what I've seen, it's doing pretty well.
I almost brought a Targ Fealty to Nationals, but I decided against it last minute because I didn't like how unreliable it could be with Beggar King. I don't like relying on, 3 cards out of 60 showing up in order to have my econ. Most of my plots are balanced around the fact that I'm going to have less gold than them, but they're going to have great utility effects, and Beggar King will give me it'll round out the numbers. And it's scary sometimes to lose a game, because you didn't draw your, a copy of your economy card. Kind of sucks.
Sure, that's true. But you have to also remember that with a Night's Watch banner, you're adding a lot of low-cost, high-impact characters. Even their army, for instance, is 4 cost with a nice 5 strength, 2 icons. Very impactful. So it allows you to play a lower economy curve in general and still be able to play out guys. And having Beggar King is just like gravy. And if you play enough draw, which is what kind of the key to this is, the same way that the key to Thomas's Night's Watch deck is getting all that extra draw going, it lets you find that Beggar King very quickly.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of people, from what I can see, are playing or thinking about Beggar King in the wrong way, in that they're thinking of it as, oh, this card where you've got to build your plot deck around it. And it's like the extent to which you have to build your plot deck around it is maybe... like you change your trading to a Summer Harvest or whatever because X counts as 0 for the sake of Beggar King. But otherwise, it's just a non-limited economy card. And I understand those are good.
I have a big question for John, which is mostly that the Watch banner actually, I've been playing around with the idea a couple of factions because Kraven is so good, because there are a couple of good parts of that package. But I'm sort of curious if you could flesh out the 12 cards that you're taking in from the Night's Watch.
Oh god, that's easy. I mean, in a Targ deck, it's a little bit different than others, but Ghost and Miri Mazdur have like this intricate sexual relationship where he stealth things and then she kills them because they can't block, and that's just awesome, right?
I question the use of the word sexual. Go on.
It's not my fault. I mean, it's this weird witch woman and a dog, and I know it's wrong, but it's what's happening.
No, a dog. They love each other.
We don't know the nature of direwolves in George R. R. Martin's world.
Yeah, it could be anything.
It's not our place to judge.
But on top of Kraven, the armies are good. Aemon is always good. Claim Soak, anytime you can get it repeated, even in a single maester, is good, so he's good. And now with Glorious Ed being able to hop in and get those intrigue challenges blocked, that's a nice card. The Reducer, you're at 12.
Yeah, and then you factor in like Ranging Party, Benjen.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I was sort of curious as to whether Benjen would make that into that list or not.
Benjen is not making my list in the Targ deck. I'm doing Ghost instead of him. In other builds, Benjen comes in.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. I think it doesn't work in the Targ deck so well, but in as a general card, I think he's very efficient.
All right. Well, I think that sort of talks us into one of the possibilities for exploring the Watch as a banner in this meta. You must have had many other ideas to start this segment, John.
Of course. I mean, I love seeing some of these decks that we're seeing, like the Kings of Winter Lannister deck. I think this is a deck that has been underplayed and was a natural fit with the Jumpers. And I know that Jakob played it to pretty good success recently. But I think we're going to see a lot more of it, especially with the birth of the Clansmen. There's, in my opinion, no better Jumper than the Clansmen. They have free Jumpers with the Kneel of a House card, and that plays into the Winter sub-theme so well.
Completely agree.
Yeah, I think that the Kings of Winter is the first place I'm going to build that deck. Although, I do wonder how dependent it is upon the centerpiece, upon Tyrion, who allows you to replenish your hand and turn those Claim 2s into Claim 3s. You know, he looks like he's game-winning. What does the deck do without
him? I don't think the deck's dependent on him. I think the deck behaves like a normal Jumper deck in the other circumstances. You're still running probably multiple copies of Cersei, Shadow Black Lane for extra draw. Sorry, what's the... I was going to say Terminal Schemes, but of course that's not the right name for the event, but the one that
Tears
changes...
Bliss?
No.
Trial by Combat.
Trial by Combat, thank you. And you're still running Trials by Combat. You still have lots of Clansmen. And you're still jumping those guys in for a variety of reasons. You know, Shaggy Son of Dolph is still going to be great. The Moon Brothers are still going to be great. And, you know, the great thing about the other Clansmen is that they are unique and they will be easily triggered by the Jumper events. So when you're searching your bottom for those five cards, you're finding a Chella or you're finding whatever other Clansmen you need and being able to play them. So I think it just fits so well with that deck that... Even if you don't get those centerpieces, the worst case scenario is it plays as well as the old Jumper deck, which was a good deck.
Mm-hmm. My only question for this deck is, do you run, what is that the building called? The forecast king hand, tower of the hand, tower of the hand. Do you run tower of the hand? Because with the Clansmen jumping in and getting icons off of the Clansmen location, you could put in a free character or a cheap ambush character, give them intrigue, and then bounce someone else out.
The only problem is you can only bounce the Chuds out. I mean, there's value in that, obviously. But.
Yeah, I mean, you clear Chuds and then get a military claim on someone, it matters.
Well, remember, you're running a Jumper deck that your characters would normally be discarded at the end of phase, and some of them already have an intrigue icon, and if you have that event, then all your Clansmen do. All your Clansmen do. And then that's just fantastic, because you can use the Tower of the Hand to keep replenishing your hand from the things that would have been discarded. So does it fit in? I think you can play a version with it and a version without it. It could be effective.
One thing that I'm interested to see is whether that deck settles on using the Clansman Tyrion or whether it just uses the efficient core one. And I hope the answer is the Clansman Tyrion, because it's more fun. And if it doesn't fit in that deck, then what deck does it fit in? But I'm slightly worried that the fact that it functions as a perfectly good Jumper deck without him, people are going to optimize the deck to work without him and then go, oh, well, since it's optimized to work without him, let's put in the efficient old one instead.
That's a really good question.
Well, he's completely game-winning if he's on the board and you can get him rolling. I mean, turning a Claim 2 into Claim 3 is fantastic. Getting that gold so you can... Because he can generate the gold, and in a Valor environment, he can return your cards to hand in a way that you actually care about it.
That's true.
I suspect that he's going to be quite good and better than the Courtyrion. I just see so much power in Hebron.
Yeah, a Cersei and a Clansman going in and then Trial by Combat for Claim, wiping boards, just sounds too sexy to pass up. And I think if you get that off, you win the game. I have to agree with Alex. And in a Jumper deck, you're not really paying the full seven for him a lot of times. You're just jumping him in, using his abilities to great effect, and you're happy. And I think a lot of these new jumper decks are probably going to run close call, so that even if someone comes towards you, kills that guy that you were going to have to discard because you use him as claim, then you'd be able to move him into your discard later and still play another copy.
I mean, the problem with that is we were talking about it as a winter deck, but I think the ones that aren't winter definitely will be running close call.
Yeah, exactly. And this is the great thing with that deck. I think there is a nice mix that people can have. You're probably not running Fealty, but other than that, you might be running Lord of the Crossing, you might be running Winter.
Yeah, I think those are the two agendas. It was actually asked in the Facebook group on, you know, today, as the day we're recording it, what agenda will people use for Clansmen? And those were the two that I said.
You know, I think that answers my question. The Tyrion Hear Me Roar, and then Tower of the Hand with Tyrion.
Hmm.
So A, he doesn't get discarded, and B, you get to bounce someone of, what, 6 gold value?
Yeah. I do like the idea of playing I Never Bet Against My Family, leaving a Tyrion in the bottom 5 cards of your deck, then later on going in with a challenge with a Clansman that's perfectly innocent. The opponent lets it through because it's not going to be that important. And then you play another I Never Bet Against My Family, pull Tyrion out to surprise, jump the Clansman back and raise the claim.
Yeah, it's terrifying.
The deck is so tricky. Like, I just love the whole idea of it. I think it's going to be really, really fun when the new box comes out. But, you know, since we're talking about decks that are underplayed in the current meta here in North America, Lannister Winter is one of them. That jumper deck is good now.
Yes, yes, it is.
It is. It's fantastic, and I love playing it. It's got a lot of different avenues in the early game that I enjoy. And I want to sort of take a step back and just mention why jumpers are good, because I know that people sort of inherently think, well, I want to keep my characters on the board. And a lot of 1.0 veterans seem to say, no, that's not the case because, well, partly because we know Valor is coming and having characters in your hand to play afterwards, or being able to put 3 or 4 characters, even if it's only for that one critical turn, with things like Hear Me Roar can be enormous, but also just the surprise factor where your opponent has no idea how the challenge phase is going to play out. I think those are two really key factors in making jumpers good. And, you know, most people have seen that the Hound's ability is not a drawback. And that's how they have to think about jumpers.
And this is one of the big things that is really important for a jumper deck. You have to have that draw. You have to be able to get those events. You have to be able to get the jumpers. You have to keep filling your hand. And I think that a lot of the top decks that people don't play a lot rely on a heavy draw because people love to be able to play their big characters right out, keep them on the board. They want these big gold plots. But I think we've moved past that now in the meta, and people have to kind of, you know, wake up and realize that we're going back more to a 1.0 style of play where draw is king.
And yeah, I think Counting Coppers is the most underplayed plot in the current meta.
Because it's only 1x in 80% of decks? That should be 2x in 50?
Well, it seems like it's in Targ you see it, and in like Night's Watch you see it. And I don't tend to see it in most other factions.
I've seen it in a fair bit of land. But only because they justify it on the grounds that they're going to have 6 or 7 gold on that turn anyway.
Yeah, I've seen it in Lani Jumper, but I've not seen it so much in like the Lani Dragon or the Lani Kraken.
The Lani Dragon that Toronto was playing was running it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That might be a European thing then, I'm not sure.
I have to agree. With
if,
you.
If at any point I seem ignorant throughout this, I'm just going to blame it on Europe.
Wait, are you not intimately familiar with all the North American decks?
I'm intimately familiar with the North American deck.
You know Canada built Lani Dragon, right?
You've only mentioned it like every time that Lani Dragon's been brought up, so I wasn't sure.
Okay, good. I just wanted to establish that for the records. But so I've been laminating about the decks that I think are underplayed. Are there any that you guys think are underplayed?
Hold on.
Laminating?
You've been laminating?
I've been laminating. Maybe not laminate. That might have been the wrong word. Did I mention I have sunstroke? I meant lamenting.
I'm glad I was able to translate.
That's good. Okay. And on to you guys.
All right. Well, I have a question that I don't know the answer to, but this is, again, because I've been spending a good portion of today, today being the day where I launched the new Annals, staring at Annals data. And I noticed that in the last 3 months, Greyjoy has made 11% of cuts and has won 17% of tournaments. That is a big difference. And I really had dismissed Greyjoy as something that is not doing well right now. We'll do better later, but I mean, Greyjoy as a main faction, as it's a lot of hit or miss, it can go down blazing. How is it doing that consistently in the cut?
I think with Greyjoy, all you need is one good swing. They do a lot of this, low character or low board presence, but they make a really big impact with it through either multiple claim plots, Seastone Share, target killing characters that actually matter, or Raiding Longship, Pike, you know, just one character being able to say, all these other characters you have don't matter. I've seen Greyjoy come back from positions where the other person was in control, they were winning, but because Greyjoy specializes in initiative, they won the first player, and then they just won the one or two challenges they needed to close the gap.
I have to say, I think you actually hit it on the head, Alex. You said that, you know, you felt that they were kind of hit and miss. And a lot of people feel that way, because I think they are too. But what happens is decks can easily be teched against Greyjoy to make sure that they win. However, no one techs against them because they feel they'll be hit and miss, and they will not see them in the cut. So I think it's kind of a perception thing that's catching up with people, that because no one's really trying to do anything to stop Greyjoy, like including a couple high initiative plots like Sean mentioned, or making sure that you have some way to control those key characters that he mentions that, you know, do these big hits, because they do play with a low board state, that they're able to surprise people in the cut and then get a much higher win percentages than play percentages. And I think that if that trend continues, people will start to put in those counters and that we'll see them even out. But that just means that they're probably in a good place. They're probably, you know, equal to most of the other houses.
But they're not having trouble making the cut particularly. They're a little underrepresented there. But what just surprises me is how once they reach the cut, they are by far the faction that is most likely to win once it makes the cut.
Out of interest, Alex, how does that break down when it comes to agendas? Like, instead of providing...
Which ones are the winners, or which ones are the...
Greyjoy runs two agendas, Fealty and Lord of the Crossing. Come on now.
Well, and Dragon, well, I've seen as well.
Yeah, it's had Fealty, Crossing, Winter. Mine. Winter has actually had four wins, as Crossing has had six, Fealty six, and Dragon three. And those are the majority of the wins.
Pick the top two.
And it's pretty close to how often they're being played as well. Crossing does slightly worse. It's more often in the cut than it is at the winning. And right now, Winter and Dragon are doing slightly better there. If you're looking at, like, rather than qualification ratio, we're looking at once you're in the cut, your chances of winning. It seems like Dragon and Winter are the ways those are going right now. But I'm still curious about it. I haven't seen the build that I've really liked out of Greyjoy.
I haven't either. And I really think it's a people are not preparing for Greyjoy type of... That's the reason that people are doing so well with it after they make the cut.
Is it the location hate, maybe?
I've cut out a bunch of the tech that I thought myself, man, this would be really, really good against Greyjoy. And I thought to myself, I'm not seeing Greyjoy. And I just cut it out of my deck for something else that'll improve me in a match that I'm more likely to encounter.
No, but the other way around, is it possible that what's propelling Greyjoy in the cut is the fact that they have location hate?
Well, the main decks in the cut aren't that heavy on locations, really, are they?
Well, Stark is, but they have the means to...
Stark is, but Winterfell's out of newly made Lord range, and unless there's a winter plot, can stop We Do Not Sow.
Right, yeah.
And then Lanny Dragon typically runs, like, no limited locations.
You can hit some Gaston or Plaza, but Plaza's not hugely impactful against Greyjoy. Yeah, I don't know what it is. I'm curious, but maybe someone will teach me.
Right, on the subject of locations, since location hate is at such a low ebb in the meta at the moment, like, it's basically, if you're playing Greyjoy, you're probably running, like, maybe one newly made Lord and then a couple of We Do Not Sows. Otherwise, you're basically running no location hate. I think there is a lot you can gain at the moment from running some of those constant power grab locations. So I'm thinking, like, the Iron Throne, Chamber of the Painted Table, as much as I hate to say it, the Bone Way. One that I think is particularly underrated generally is Small Council Chamber. And I think that's just because Lanny have easier ways of winning than having to faff about with it. But I think a deck that actually tried to make use of that location could do very well in the current meta, because no one is really playing against it. And with
Bera Fealty or a Bera to is Boneway loyal?
It is. No. Yes.
So it would have to be a Martell. Really? It would have to be a Martell to Bera.
Yeah, Martell. Table. And I mean, Martell Banner of the Stag was joint King of Swiss at the UK Nationals and only lost on a timed loss in the top four to the deck that eventually won. And that deck's available on Throne's DB, but that was essentially a stall deck playing Gaston, Boneway, Chamber of the Painted Table, Iron Throne. And unless it plays against Greyjoy, no decks really have the tech to deal with that at the moment. And with the icon removers and Kraven, if you're playing with Night's Watch, to sort of shut down the renown characters. It's actually quite difficult for even the big character decks to get enough renown quickly enough to beat them to 15 power.
I'm curious about that, because Kraven and the icon removal attachments actually play directly against your ability to win dominance.
This is true, but the Iron Throne sort of typically will counterbalance that enough. Or you're poking with attacks, and either they're kneeling out these Kraven characters to defend them, or they are letting you get unopposed power, and then you don't mind if they win dominance at that point.
Or, yeah, they block them, and then you get the bone way hit, and you're like, oh, every time I lose, it's half a power.
It's like there are three different ways this can go, and I'm kind of happy with all of them.
Along that thought, what about a Martell Banner of the Watch, bone way plus the wall plus all the dominance, Iron Throne? And
Sean, you're going to be building a Martell Banner of the Watch for this to showcase? That is fantastic.
I will say it is one of the most boring Ascend decks to play.
And it's all about losing, which I've proven I can do.
Don't be bitter about your second place. It's what made you part of the cast.
I think me joining and doing a lot of the editing is what made me part of the cast.
No, you weren't really a member until you took second place in a major event.
I'm somewhat curious, because we have talked about some of these leveling cards, that things like Kraven, things like Milk of the Poppy, that really don't care about the character quality that your opponent has put on. They're going to negate it regardless. And there are other cards that do that, notably Varus, for instance, and there's a person currently on the cast who is prominently playing a Varus deck. Surely they should argue that that is an underplayed deck that suits the meta.
Yeah. John, when are you going to pipe up? Varus is good. I don't know why people shy away from him. I think people are just sort of scared of him being like mirrored or Seasome Chaired or whatever before you can trigger him, or they're worried about their own characters going away. I don't know, but
I think the concern for Varys is treachery, and given the prevalence of Lannister.
I mean, treachery is a pain in the balls.
Yeah, don't come to Canada with Varys.
But the thing is, treachery is not impossible to deal with. There are multiple factions can either hit hard for entry claim, or can have targeted removal of cards in hand, or can run easy event cancel. Like, there's very few factions that would want to run Varus where they don't have an answer for treachery. And obviously you're not always going to see it, but they're not always going to see the treachery. And typically also the decks that want to run Varus also run several other things they want to treachery. So
I would say that the issue for me with Varus isn't that he's going to get treachery. It's that it's not necessarily that consistent to draw him when he becomes such an important part of how the deck plays out. And that's, I think, a lot of what you did with Sun Garden. Was basically make the deck more consistent with Gifts of Arbor Red and Baron Maiden Fairs and other ways to look for that character that you really do need.
When you're playing summons and six deck stacking events and pleasure barges, it becomes a lot easier to consistently find that Varus.
So I wonder if that might open us to another thing, which we've talked about County Coppers and we've talked about, deck stacking and things like that. It seems to me like, we may be seeing a push towards decks that are more consistent than what we've seen so far. You know, Landy Dragon is consistently winning. It's a strong deck. It's in an aggro meta, it's definitely doing that because it has a lot of interchangeable pieces as well, getting those big military challenges through, whether you have Jamie or Gregor can work. But I think we're starting to see more decks get to the point of consistency. I think one of the examples is Thomas's Nice Watch deck, that is running two Counting Coppers, that has got all that draw, that is looking for, doesn't really care whether it's a Milk or a Kraven, doesn't really care, what a lot of the cards it draws are, it just needs the options to be able to answer things and mitigate, sort of the variance of the game with, in this case, draw and economy that's based on draw. I suspect that tournament-level players are going to favor that approach because they tend to not like situations that are unpredictable.
I have to totally agree, Alex. I mean, we saw the same thing with DC's deck where they were running a whole bunch of these armies that had no attachments. And when I talked to them after the Gen Con about it, I said, why'd you do that? And they said, well, for consistency. If we're running these armies instead of these big characters, you can't be Melt, they can't be Kraven, you can't do anything about them. I'm going to see them and they're going to be useful the same way all the time.
Yeah.
That's why they love Wildling Horde. That's why they love all the other armies.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that was originally done by Brandon Zimmer, MN Broncos. He posted a Martell Lion deck to ThronesDB a few months back, and that was one of the things that helped inspire the Sun Garden, was seeing those four-cost Martell armies and the Wildling Horde just sort of filling that interchangeable mid-range beatstick role. And it really does help make your deck more consistent when you can reliably get these characters that can't be messed with by the opponent's attachments, can't be first snowed, will just provide 4 or 5 strength on a military icon. And you'll be amazed how much better a deck runs when you can reliably see those cards every game.
Yeah, so if you have 9 of them, and they all do basically the same thing, the consistency goes way up. And then after that, you just need to be able to draw those other pieces, which again, you can get consistency through bannering. And I know that in the DC deck, they were bannering to Stark so that they could have, you know, icon control through the icon attachments. And in the Stark matches, they could steal those key characters like Catelyn with Ward. So they had this great control effect where they could make sure that they could always take your opponents and then march them away, of course, the next turn before the attachment could be removed. It gave a lot of power to the deck and consistency.
And so is that something that will, because we've seen some of these decks that try for that consistency, we're going to see more of it because it just catches on? Or is this just a natural progression of the card?
You know, it's a natural progression.
More, yeah?
I have to agree. The card pool, I mean, at first you couldn't get consistency because the card pool wasn't big enough. I think we basically have now hit that key point where the card pool is big enough that people can start building those decks. And in 6 months from now, that those will be the decks that everyone's playing. Everyone's going to be playing a deck that's more consistent, because what is the worst thing in the world but going to a major event and losing because you set up improperly, or losing because you didn't draw that key card you really needed to make your deck work? That's no fun.
John, why you gotta hurt me?
Oh, no. Alex was telling me, I mean, I didn't see the stream, but he said you lost because you played poorly?
Is that what you said, Alex?
What?
Not true.
What? Why would I say that, unless it were true?
Ouch.
I haven't said it. This is just all linguistic gymnastics. But
My excuse for that tournament was I took the safe setup instead of mulliganing for Tywin, whereas my opponent on their first setup, who played excellently, by the way, obviously he won the whole event, so that's awesome. He's a newer player too, so this is all very exciting. I can only imagine, you know, being a new player and getting all the way to the top of a huge premier event like that with a lot of good players. Anyways, he set up a duped Tywin with a reducer and a Rose Robe.
I hear that's win, actually. Did you shake his hand at that point?
Yeah, I think on stream you can hear me say, good game.
All right, so what are some other variance mitigating factors? We mentioned JC's approach, which has been some of Tyrell's deck stacking. Summons and things like that. We've mentioned Tamas, who has ways to convert, you know, a lot of different options in a ton of card draw through the deck. What are some other tricks you guys have seen for variants?
We talked about DCs, you know, running the same character with different names over and over again.
Yeah, the same character with different names.
On a similar note for that, I'd look at the Hod Gates of Winterfell deck that's been doing the rounds in the UK, where it runs 47 characters, all of the big uniques at 3 copies, so 3 Eddard, 3 Blackfish, 3 King Rob's Host, 3 Caitlin, 3 John. And, you know, maybe you're not going to see all of them every game, but you'll see multiple ones every single game, probably duplicated.
I mean, if you can't draw it, you got to search for it, right? So I know JC's searching through events, but you can do double summons. That's basically, those three ways are the only three ways to do it to mitigate that, the randomness.
I think there are quite a few different approaches within the card pool to accomplish some of these. So, for instance, we've seen the Night's Watch deck running 2x Counting Coppers and 3 Messenger Ravens, 2 Airy, etc. But we're seeing more Targ decks with Funeral Pyre and Daria who are getting that draw, like the Knights, the one you were talking about earlier, a Targ Night's Watch or a Targ Banner of the Watch, because you can crank up the draw and therefore smooth out variants and make it a competitive deck. So I think different factions are only capable of one or two of these approaches. Some of them just don't have the middle of the curve to really pad it out and get consistent characters with the same name, while some just don't have the draw tools to really, aside from Counting Coppers, I guess, which everybody has.
Right, and the others don't have the search effects that Tyrell does, though, you know, almost any house could run double summons if the search effect you're looking for is a character. Tyrell's great in that, you know, it's location, character, attachment, whatever it is you need, it can find. So we've been talking about a few of the decks that we thought, you know, are top tier that we've not seen a lot of here in North America. Are there any more that come to mind?
Well, you trounced me like 6 times with a Barrow deck.
Oh, I'm not sure if my Barrow weapon deck is top tier, but
I don't think I ever saw any other weapons. I just forgot that initiative matters in this game. You managed to get Robert to smash me and intimidate me every single turn.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of cards, actually, that people are not playing that have really great value. People are forgetting about that. Search for an item or weapon. That is an amazing card in Barra. Being able to find additional stand for some of those big guys that you were mentioning, Alex, has huge impacts on the game. And I think people need to start to re-examine those cards as the card pool grows and not forget about them. I know that there's one that searches for allies or companions for 5 cards, which right now I still don't think is good. But in 6 months from now, might just be amazing.
Mm-hmm. I'm really looking forward to that card and Hot Pie being useful together.
I'm not convinced that, like, I think Hot Pie will be good because it's neutral, non-limited economy. I'm not convinced Street of Silk will ever be good.
I know the weapons one is good in some houses now, and will probably get better as more weapons are released.
What about the power street? JC was just saying other ways to increase your power gain. And that, I mean, that's one of the problems we're seeing with Lannister against the Night's Watch, is that they just stall out on the power gain when they don't have the renown and when they have cravens on the
major I like targets. It in melee. I like it in Tyrell Lords of the Crossing.
Yeah, I think the problem is because it's a win by 5, you have to distort either your deck or your playstyle to get it to work consistently. So unless you're having other win by 5 payoffs in your deck, it's tough to justify.
Hey, I just solved the Rubik's Cube I was playing with.
Congratulations.
But James, I wanted to ask you something. What is the deck that you think is going to be the best after the Liney box? I mentioned the Clansman Jumper Winter deck. What would be yours?
I mean, I don't know about the best, but the deck that I'm most looking forward to playing is...
Oh, do I get to guess it? Do I get to guess it?
Go on.
Do I get to guess the faction, at least?
Yeah, the faction is a major shock, I'm sure.
Okay, but it's going to be Tyrell with a new agenda, right?
It's going to be Tyrell with the new agenda. So, for me, when you're looking at decks that aren't just doing the sort of the normal standard aggro thing and aren't just relying on the consistency, you're looking at faction themes beyond that. And one of Tyrell's main faction themes is strength pumps, but at least it's meant to be. But if you look at the card pool at the moment, you're not really lacking for ways to boost strength, because, you know, there's Marjorie, there's Heartsbane, there's Growing Strong, there's the Arbor Knight. But as far as reasons to do it beyond just winning the challenge, there's Randall to trigger him to stand, and there's the Manda to win by 5, and that's it. Like, I mean, at a push.
And Street of Sisters.
Well, yeah, but that's neutral.
Yeah.
I mean, at a push, you could say, if you boost people's strength with Growing Strong and then win a challenge with the Queen of Thorns, you can drop in a House Florent Knight to discard something better or jank like that. But
so Reigns really helps that deck, right? Because it gives it a reason to win by 5.
Yes, it gives it another reason to win by 5, which means that you can actually justify at that point playing the strength pump effects just for the sake of the strength pump, because when it's just the Manda and then being able to trigger Randall, it's like, I mean, that's fine, but you're not going to put in Growing Strong on the off chance that you draw it when you have the Manda out. Whereas when it's on your agenda, you know, it's a perfectly legitimate choice at that point. And the other thing that I think is very important is that Reigns of Castamere, people have been looking at it and complaining about the lack of drawback. Like, you know, oh, you can't run schemes in your main plot deck, but that's not much of a drawback, and in return you get to plot cycle, etc. The drawback that people miss is the opportunity cost, because it is essentially blank unless you can win your intrigue by 5 or more strength. And if you're trying to do that, you're having to commit a serious amount of strength if the opponent has any kind of border tool. You can't just go in with like one character, like maybe unless you're Lannister and have Tywin or something like that.
But or your Tyrell.
Well, and the new Cersei, which doesn't kneel. But yeah.
Well, even the new Cersei, if you oppose with one guy, then they're not getting their win by 5 trigger off it. Hmm. But so what the agenda therefore does is it means that you have to call your shot essentially and commit X amount of strength, and all the opponent has to do is stop the win by 5, and your agenda is useless.
Especially if you consider the factions that are built around stopping the win by 5s, like Night's Watch.
Yeah, the thing with Tyrell, on the other hand, though, is I can go in an injury challenge with, like, say, an Arbor Knight with a Meryn Heat attached. And at that point, how much strength do you need to defend with to stop me winning by 5?
Depends on your character distribution, because
close to a bajillion.
Like, if I've got a couple of gold remaining, say, you don't know if I've got a Growing Strong in my hand, you don't know if I'm just planning on paying the gold to boost him and then using Marjorie, you don't know, like, yeah, there are several tricks that you can do at that point. And what it essentially does is it reverses the downside of the agenda and makes the opponent have to do the overcommitting so as to stop you from being able to later on push to win by 5. And then if they do overcommit, then you can save those strength pumps to use on another challenge. And so suddenly the agenda, even if you're not triggering it, is doing the work by making the opponent have to preemptively defend against it.
In
which
excess.
Only Tyrell can really do. I mean, Lannister has got ambushing in a widow's wail by surprise is about the only trick they can do.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think the biggest enemy to that agenda will probably be Dolorous Ed with a wall, you know, a surprise force strength popping out. But even then, Tyrell could get
him. Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest enemy of the agenda will be Catelyn Stark and Winterfell. But...
Yeah.
Oh, wait, oh yeah.
The trigger entirely.
that's, yeah, tier two is Ed. Tier one is definitely Kat and Winterfell.
But yes, Ed will be annoying as well, for sure. Oh, and the other small advantage that Tyrell have is that, like, Lannister quite often want to use their faction card for something. The only Tyrell card that Neil's a faction card is Gift of Arbor Red. So I think that's a worthwhile sacrifice to be able to run the agenda. Whereas with Lannister, you're turning down, I never bet against my family. You're probably running Shadow Black Lane normally in Lannister to get all their awesome in-faction events. And Tyrell doesn't really have many awesome in-faction events, so you can easily go without that there.
But you just got some promo Gift of Arbor Reds.
I did just get some promo Gift of Arbor Reds. I got some promo Much and More.
I would have said that one of the problems with the deck that you're proposing is that it was lacking high-strength intrigue icons to start with. But we do have Renly coming in the next pack as well.
We did. We got the new king. We got the Queen of Thorns. They have some big, beefy intrigue. And you...
They do, yeah. But Queen of Thorns has been relegated to a somewhat secondary role.
There's romance in there.
On the subject of Renly, can we just address him for a moment? Because I've heard, this isn't strictly on topic, but I've heard a lot of people claiming that he is bad.
No, he's super good. Stop saying that.
I don't understand.
Crazy good.
Is it basically just people getting hung up on the cannot be saved thing? Because that irritates me as well.
Yeah, this is one thing that I've heard, is people complaining that he's the only king with a drawback. And it's like, but the drawback is weighed into how awesome he is without it. Like, take Balon, for instance.
Balon does have a drawback. He's useless if your opponent... I mean, he's a complete waste of a 7 coster.
Exactly. But people are like,
good.
It's not that he's got a drawback if they've got a king. He's just even better if they don't. And it's like, yeah, Renly is a cannot-be-saved character that is awesome, and then if the opponent doesn't have a king, he's even more awesome because you can save him now.
Yeah. And... I think one of the points, too, is how often are you actually saving your kings, right? I mean, you don't always have dupes. You're not saving characters as often as people think they are.
The other thing I've heard is Tyrell don't need more draw, they need more bombs. And it's like, A, he is a bomb. B, you always need more draw.
Yeah, he's a bomb
about that consistency.
Withdraw.
Yeah,
Tyrell loves the renown. Loves it.
Yeah, we were just talking about how you need consistency, and one of the ways to get it is draw. And we're talking about a card that can draw you multiple cards per turn.
I think another great card coming out of this chapter pack for Tyrell is the Crown of Golden Roses.
Yes.
I think that'll make Randy's trigger even more reliable.
It's still into phase, too, isn't it? I'm still looking at the Chinese text card, but I think someone translated that.
Yeah.
I'm not loving that card, but, you know, each their own.
With Renly to give you cards to discard...
Apparently Tyrell does need more draw.
And it's twice per round, so you could actually do Randy twice off of that, right?
Yeah.
How many times can you trigger Randy?
Twice per round.
Oh, so that's the perfect number.
Yeah.
It is.
Convenient, huh?
Yeah, they thought of everything.
Yeah, give Randall a little bird, and then it gives you +3 strength, and go in for an intrigue challenge with Randall, and try and stop me triggering Reigns of Castamere.
Just use it on your new king. He's already got 3 icons.
But this gives you the option. You know, you're not necessarily going to see Renly before you see Randy.
Yeah, this is the point, again, going back to consistency, is that Tyrell is starting to get interchangeable good characters at that top end. And I mean, we also have Brienne, who's been spoiled but won't be out until, I think, sort of like pack 6 or something. But she is also very good.
I think it's worth mentioning again, because one of the reasons that Banner of the Rose was so good in the early game was because factions did not have the depth of renowned characters, of pressure interchangeable characters that they have now. And Tyrell offered you a 5 and a 6 cost character that were basically interchangeable that allowed you to do that part of the game. I think that's why Banner of the Rose was popular early on and why it's faded since. And I think people do have to pay attention to not only the power of a character, but how consistently you can fill that role within your deck.
And in case people are looking for reasons to Banner to the Rose again, I hear non-loyal, non-uniques with renown are quite good.
Yeah, the Knight of Summer?
Yeah. Yeah, if we're talking about consistent power gain, taking you being able to take Randall, Knight of Flowers, and 3 Knights of Summer and put them in a rush deck from another faction.
I think Greyjoy Rose will rise again.
Yeah, Greyjoy Rose, Stark Rose, Lanny Rose. There's a lot of decks that can put it to great use, I think.
So, Alex, we've all mentioned a deck that we are pumped about now or in the near future. Do you have one for us?
I have two. One's probably more interesting than the other. So one is just seeing Littlefinger's meddling and thinking, my goodness, is that a great Barricard with even-handed justice and some of the things that you play out.
Are you thinking about on a Littlefinger's meddling turn playing even-handed justice and then ours is the Fury?
Wouldn't that be fantastic?
I am, in fact,
thinking of that. And obviously, I've ranted about how much I love the new Tywin, and I will definitely be building something like that. But one of my most immediate decks that I want to build, and that hopefully we'll be able to do very, very soon with the cards that are coming out, is more Targ, more emphasis on the Dothraki. We're getting two cards for that theme already straight up. I'm already enjoying a Targ Kings of Summer that I like a lot, and that these cards, the Devoted Blood Rider and Blood of My Blood, are going to slot in and give me that consistency. Basically, consistency is what you're looking for, and both of those cards are doing it.
Blood of My Blood's so solid.
Yeah. Blood of My Blood might be one of the best cards in the cycle, like out of the ones we've seen.
It's fantastic.
I have a question for you. Why Kings of Summer over Fealty? Because I made a Dothraki deck that's Fealty, and it's running a mix of Summer and Winter. Summer for the Econ and Winter for the two-claim pressure with Khal Drogo.
I've been using Summer because I needed the reserve increase because I was trying a version that had a lot more draw. Three Funeral Pyres and some other toys to it, including Doria and things like that. If I switch more to Dothraki, that may change. I'd have to look at the balance. But neither of those new events are loyal, and I only have, and I really like Funeral Pyre for the draw, and that's already competing with the field. So I'm thinking you probably get more value elsewhere.
Since you mentioned that one of the reasons you're playing it out of Summer is for the reserve, can I very briefly segue into a mini rant about people playing the Summer agenda wrong?
Oh, pray do.
So you're actually playing it right. What I've seen is people who have, they're building summer themed decks around, you know, like the Tyrell Knight of Summer, or around, you know, Aggo in Targaryen or whatever. And they're thinking, okay, well, since I'm doing five summer plots, I'll use the summer agenda. No. The summer agenda, if you're using it like that, you're basically asking, like, you're going to make your curve based around assuming you get one extra gold per round, then you're going to play a deck that's got like three winter plots in it, and you're going to struggle. The point of that agenda is to be a fealty substitute when you need the reserve boost and when you're either over 15 neutrals or you need the faction card Neil for something else. It's not just I've got a bunch of summer plots, so I'm going to run it, because that doesn't automatically make it preferable to field.
Yeah, and that's basically, are you using the faction Neil, and do you have enough loyal to justify fealty, because it can also be useless. I have occasionally found myself building decks where I realized I only have four or five loyal characters in there, but those aren't that common. But yeah, I think that really a huge portion of it is milking the reserve game, which is the portion that when you read it, you dismiss it because it's giving it to your opponent.
Neutral.
But it's not giving your opponent the cards that they need to make that reserve matter.
I think the neutral is a really, really big piece. There's a few times that I start to build a deck and say, oh man, I'm at 14 neutral. I just can't cut anything that I want, or the deck will suffer from it. And that's when I turn to the summer. I'm like, oh, I'm already running three or four summer plots. Maybe fealty isn't the right choice here.
This is when I think it's the right call, but I've seen too many people running it because they're running summer, which I think is absolutely the wrong decision.
Well, it's definitely the wrong decision if you're running winter.
Yeah. Likewise, with Kings of Winter, I think people are running Kings of Winter. They're putting in their deck correctly because they want to exploit the agenda. But then they're thinking, okay, well, since I'm doing that, I need to run five winter plots. I think the best Kings of Winter decks I've seen are running three winter plots.
Yeah, that's true.
First Snow of Winter.
But I think it's harder to get winter wrong because of the inherent synergy between Wraiths and Famine and the agenda.
Yeah, Wraiths, First Snow, and Famine are the three that actually synergize with the agenda. Mm-hmm. If you're running any more than that, you have to have a good reason why, in my opinion. Like, you actually actively want a second low gold two flame plot, yep, for instance. But I think a lot of people are running, you know, like the Winds of Winter or Snowed Under or whatever, just because they've got a Kings of Winter deck. And I think most of the time, other plots will do a better job for you.
I think you're forgetting about Winter Festival and Long Winter, which are both excellent plots.
I think a lot of people that are playing Winter Festival and Long Winter aren't necessarily playing them because they're excellent plots for their deck. They're playing them because they've got the winter trait and are generically good, and those plots don't actually suit what the deck is trying to accomplish.
I can't argue with that because it's right. Damn it.
Also, to be fair, it's anecdotal, so it's also tough to argue with it for that reason.
No, it's easy to argue with it. It's tough to, you know, prove you wrong or right or anything.
I'll see your anecdotal evidence and raise you. Here's my personal experience. I think my personal gripe with the Kings of Season decks are that you can't properly tech against the opposing season. Or rather, I shouldn't say that. I should say your own season. I think that's the way it works, right? Is where Kings of Winter is countered by Summer. Remember, I have a fever. And I like to run another agenda, something else, and then have in my plot deck enough tools to handle any King of blah, King of X that comes at me. I find they tend to apply their technique early, whether it be Kings of Winter opening with Wraiths and trying to reserve choke you, or Summer trying to flood the board with Chuds.
On the subject of Kings of Winter opening with Wraiths, by the way, I was playing against a Kings of Winter with my Game Night Kit deck the other day, and I set up an Iron Throne and opened with Counting Coppers. So on their Wraiths turn, I had 8 reserve.
Yeah, that's an excellent
I've had that as well, yeah.
Although the problem was I only had 1 gold because of the Winter agenda and not having set up economy, so I still had to discard multiple cards.
I saw at Barberg, and I really liked this play. Greyjoy Kings of Winter that was opening Wraiths and bowling up with heads on spikes. I really do like that play. Really.
It's very intelligent. They made room for heads on spikes by not running Snowed Under unnecessarily.
Yep. I think we are drifting, and that's about what I wanted to. Does anyone have any final comments on the focus of the segment before we close it off?
I guess I'd like to say that just because we're talking about all these other cool decks, that doesn't mean we're saying that stuff like, you know, Lani Dragon or Lani Kraken or whatever are bad decks. They're all still very good decks. And we're not necessarily saying these decks are better or worse, just that they aren't being considered as much as they should be considered, and that the meta would be a more diverse place if people would take the time to try these decks, get over the threshold of, you know, not knowing what they're doing, so of course you're not going to do that well with it, get to the point where you actually understand what you're doing, try the decks out. You never know, you might find something that you like more, and then maybe your next opponent won't groan when they see your faction and agenda, and you won't feel guilty about it.
I think it's a good note to end on, although I don't think you should ever feel guilty about playing the thing that's played too much.
I'm a middle-class white British male. I feel guilty about everything in my life.
As you should.
I don't think that's true. I don't think he should feel guilty about any of those things.
He said he was British, Sean.
All right, closing comments. John, what do we have for closing comments? That thing where we were going to talk about what some of the next few episodes and our schedule leading up to our winter break was going to be.
Sure. That's what we were going to talk about. It's probably in the spreadsheet.
It is. We talked about that.
Well, I know that you and Sean have organized some review of some products that are Throne related.
We should be getting some products to review on the cast coming up fairly soon. You have been paying attention. It warms the cockles of my heart, Dognosh.
Well, actually, I reached out to the product owners and tried to set something up, and they told me that you and Sean had already set something up and just not included me.
Oh, yeah. We're very... We didn't want you getting your dirty hands on that old product.
Yeah.
We wanted to save you. We wanted to save you the shipping costs of after we've reviewed it on air, then we'll ship it out.
Yeah, I mean, that's fair. It's all about you guys. It's cool.
Some of the upcoming stuff, we certainly have a couple of big episodes scheduled, and that we normally do an episode after Worlds where we've interviewed people from Worlds. An interview after Stalic, where we talk to people from Stalic. The thing with the Stalic episode, though, is that would normally air on our current schedule on the 28th of November, which is directly after Stalic and gives us almost no time
for
interviews. So that's not going to happen. So we're already getting this well in advance. The episode that would normally air on the 28th will air a week later and catch as many of the Stalic interviews we can.
See, if I'd known this was what you're talking about, we had this discussion, Alex.
We did, exactly. aside from that, I don't think there's anything we really need to announce. So we need a snappy sign off.
Well, it's up to you this week. It says so in the spreadsheet.
There's mine all over my keyboard.
Thank you for listening to Beyond the Wall.
If you have any comments or would like to be featured on the cast, please let us know by email at beyondthewallpodcast@gmail.com or through Facebook at Beyond the Wall Podcast. If you've enjoyed the music, check out more of Antti Martikainen's work at the link embedded in the chapter data. See you all next week.